Good morning, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm your host, John Sloop, along with my co-hosts, Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty. Now, our most recent programs dealt with the sanctity of life, that was a couple weeks ago, and the Convention of States initiative last week. Well, there have been some exciting developments on both those counts that we would like to bring you up to speed about. Dean, share with us about our trip to Washington for the March for Life, our serendipitous meeting with Bob Goodlatte, and a bill that was passed.
Well, John, you were on that bus too, and so I would look forward to your comments as well. But just briefly, we had a loaded bus, 55 people from the Valley. We picked them up in New Market, Luray, Front Royal. And when we got there, the first thing we did was meet Bob Goodlatte, who had just come off the floor of the House, and he was victorious. I mean, he was really feeling good about the fact that the House of Representatives had just passed a bill that would prohibit any taxpayer funding for abortion. And we were just so delighted with that news. And then, of course, from there, we went to the site of the rally. Several hundred thousand people were there just being encouraged and inspired to stand up for life. And then we marched an hour and a half from the beginning of the march to the end of the march up to the Supreme Court, where we paused to listen to ladies and, in fact, even a doctor saying, "I regret my abortion and my role in aborting unborn babies." It was an inspiring time.
Yeah, to me, Dean, that was the highlight, if you can call it a highlight, hearing those testimonies, because they were so tragic. The brokenness was so real. And yet, if everybody in Congress could have heard those testimonies, I think it would have a tremendous impact.
And one more comment too, John. We were inspired, I think, by the number of young people that were there. I would say 75% of those of the rally marchers might have been under 25 years of age. It was tremendous, the energy.
And as we commented last time, the tremendous numbers of Roman Catholic brothers and sisters with just, as you say, hundreds upon hundreds of youth groups and high schools. It's encouraging for the future, and I believe that the day will come when Roe v. Wade will be overturned.
And that was your first time on the march, right?
My first time, and I was just excited to go.
Yeah, good.
Well, Rita, I know that you spent a long day at the General Assembly yesterday in Richmond, and that you were championing the cause of the Convention of States initiative. And I haven't had a chance to talk with you, but I understand you have good news.
That's right. I am here to tell you that Virginia is on fire for freedom.
Fantastic.
And we proved that last Tuesday in Richmond. We had a huge crowd of folks come out in the middle of a nor'easter, as you know, to rally for the Republic at Capitol Square with Mike Ferris and our sponsor delegate Scott Lingenfelter. Then we all went into the General Assembly building. We met with our legislators. We attended two committee hearings, one in the House and one in the Senate. And I am so excited to announce that our Convention of States project application passed with flying colors in both committees, so we'll be proceeding quickly to the floor for a vote. And just as a reminder to anyone who missed our program last week, this is an effort to use Article 5 of the Constitution so that the states collectively can rein in the power of the federal government through constitutional amendments.
Rita, I'm surprised by this change, because I was with you and Dean last year when we were trying to talk to legislators about this and got some pushback from some of our really good friends. What, in your mind, turned the tide?
I think a lot of it just had to do with time. This is a big deal.
Yes.
This is a really big deal. And so the legislators needed time to be educated, to have their very good questions answered, and the grassroots needed time to understand the process and really get active.
I would say too, John, and I'll just personalize this. I think a lot of us have been concerned about the risks of this Convention of States. We heard about a runaway convention, but I have come to the conclusion that the way we're going now is not working. And this is the only tool in our toolbox. We need to pull it out, and we need to use it. And I think a lot of legislators have come to that same conclusion.
Absolutely right.
I remember, Dean, that last year that you had cold feet on this, and I didn't because I trust Rita. And if Rita is for it, and if Mike Ferris is for it, then I'm for it.
But Bob Marshall is against it, and we both have a lot of respect for Bob Marshall. I just want to add this yet, John. What we did in Washington a week ago and what Rita did earlier this week in Richmond is what this program is all about.
That's right.
Rita has always said, we're not a chit-chat society. We have got to put our boots on the ground. And that's why I welcome our listeners to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.
That's right.
Fantastic. Now, our conversation today is equally vital and important, because we're going to talk today about marriage, the law, and you. Now, this is a timely issue because I understand the Supreme Court has recently announced that this spring they will finally be hearing cases that challenge the historic biblical understanding of marriage as between one man and one woman. Can I just tell you, Dean and Rita, that the very term same-sex marriage is offensive to me. It makes my blood curdle, because it seeks to normalize and legalize a behavior and a lifestyle which the Bible unequivocally calls sin. We are now, I believe, living out the prophecy of Isaiah when he said in chapter 5, verse 20, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." And I'm going to tell you, this whole idea of same-sex unions is a bitter pill to swallow. Now, the Bible, the believer's only source of authority and guide for righteousness and morality, it's just simply unambiguous on the definition and the purpose of marriage. Our listeners know these texts. In Genesis 2:24, we read God's original design for marriage. "For this reason, a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh." That's God's design. And in the Gospels, both in Matthew and Mark, Jesus reiterates God's original design for marriage and adds his own commandment, where Jesus said, "They are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." So the Bible is clear. God's gift of sexual intimacy and the blessing of bringing children into the world and nurturing them in families is exclusively to be lived out in the relationship of one man and one woman in a covenant for life. The author of Hebrews puts it this way: "Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral."
Okay, Doc, well, how do you respond to those who say the Bible is just a book written by a bunch of men, it's outdated, it's full of old-fashioned moral standards that need to be changed because times have changed?
Well, Rita, that's the key question, isn't it? Last week, I overheard two of my grandsons in a heated debate over the rules of some game that they were playing. And the older one is always trying to impose his will on the younger one. And he sort of arbitrarily declared some rule. And little Benny responded, "Who says so?" So at the crossroads where faith and culture meet, the question is being asked, when it comes to marriage, who has the say-so? Now, our founders were of one voice that nature's God and his revealed truth in the Bible will be our source of authority in ordering society around standards of morality. We know this is the case because, as we've learned in the capstone courses and in America's religious heritage courses provided by the Family Forum, that the Bible is the single most often quoted book in the writings of the founders by a far majority. And the very first Congress in 1789 used tax dollars to purchase Bibles to be taught in the schools, because that first Congress understood that apart from that biblical foundation, our society could not survive. So we're facing another one of those sea change moments in our history We're in a great culture war between those of us who want to uphold the authority of the Bible in the definition of marriage and family and the secular humanists who promote a moral relativism where pretty much anything goes.
Hey, John, if I could just add to that, do you see the shirt I'm wearing right now?
National War College, I see it.
I got this shirt 25 years ago. It's been on the shelf ever since. And this morning I said to myself, Dean, you got to wear it because you have just said it. We are in a war.
Yeah, and Dean, that sweatshirt's a little bit tight on you, I will say, after all these years.
It shrank.
Yeah, it shrank, right. Yeah, it is a culture war. Yeah. And I think that for too long, the church and that great silent majority has simply allowed things to go along.
John, I want to go back to the scripture that you cited about a man shall cleave to his wife and they shall become one flesh. There's a verse before that that says, you shall be fruitful and multiply. There's only one relationship that can do that. And as you said, it's not same-sex marriage. I object to that phrase too. It's natural marriage.
Now, Rita, in your work with the Rutherford Institute and your work as a constitutional lawyer, you followed marriage law. And so it's complex. Give us an overview of what's been happening in the courts and what you see for the future of marriage.
Well, I'll just give you a quick background. The Supreme Court really started on this trend of taking liberties with constitutional text in order to invent these rights that people would like to have. In 1965, the Supreme Court decided Griswold versus Connecticut, where it found a right of privacy in the Constitution having to do with contraception. Now, fast forward to the early 2000s, we see Vermont legalize same-sex civil unions. We see the Supreme Court in Lawrence versus Texas find that this right of privacy protects the act of sodomy so that sodomy can no longer be outlawed. We see the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court order recognition of what it called same-sex marriage. And then between 2004 and 2013, 30 states responded to these trends by acting to protect marriage, traditional marriage, through constitutional amendments defining marriage the way God defines marriage in the Bible.
That was at the state level. Each state did that.
At the state level, that's right. In 2006, here in Virginia, we passed such a constitutional amendment defining marriage as a union between only one man and one woman. Then in the past few years, we have seen the federal courts really on this crusade, it seems, against the state's protection of traditional marriage. The Supreme Court overturned the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, not on privacy grounds, which was a departure from the earlier trends of using privacy as the way to give a constitutional right for this kind of behavior. But the court said, shockingly, that defining marriage as one man, one woman, had no good basis other than animus against homosexual individuals. This I find to be a shocking conclusion. So it based that decision really on the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Then let me bring it closer to home for us. In Virginia last year, our Attorney General, Mark Herring, whose very job description is defending Virginia's laws and Constitution, he not only failed to do that, but he actually joined the plaintiffs who were challenging Virginia's constitutional amendment enacted by the people defining marriage as one man, one woman. A federal court struck down Virginia's marriage amendment as violating the federal constitution's equal protection clause, and other federal courts in other states have done the same. The result is that we now have 37 states recognizing same-sex marriage, most of them because of a court order. It's because of judicial tyranny over the will of the people. And now, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court is going to take up the issue in April, and we expect a decision in June because of a circuit split among the federal appeals courts on this issue.
Well, Rita, back to the 2014 Supreme Court overturning of DOMA. That's the same Supreme Court we have now, right?
Yep.
So it doesn't look too good, does it, that they're going to come down on the side of biblical, historic, traditional marriage?
You know, I have a little bit more hope for this other decision, because this case really presents an issue of federalism. Do the states preserve the prerogative to define marriage for purposes of state law? Whereas the DOMA decision was a decision of federal law. It was a question of the federal definition. So I am cautiously optimistic.
But may I add two comments on that? First of all, they decided to take this case because one appellate court really upheld the state's rights to define marriage. So the Supreme Court had to come in, but they chose to come in on the heels of that particular district court. And the second reason is, I hope, this is only a hope and we're only speculating here, that the Supreme Court will have learned a lesson from Roe v. Wade to impose their will on the people who have chosen otherwise. I hope they have learned a lesson that the Supreme Court ought to let the states and the people decide.
That's right. This is really an issue of federal tyranny.
Yes.
It is the federal government and specifically the federal judiciary usurping the prerogative that in our Constitution is clearly left to the states and the people under the 10th Amendment. The federal government has no business in this. And again, that brings me back to the Convention of States project.
Exactly right.
That is the only way, as I see it, to really end this federal judicial tyranny.
But as I understand it now, the way that the application has been written, it would not include something like this, would it?
Well, the application certainly doesn't say anything specific to marriage law, but what would absolutely be germane under our application is a system of real, effective checks and balances on the federal courts. That's what we need to happen.
It's exciting. I hope that more and more states sign on.
Well, John, I just want to take off from where Rita is. She talked about the rule of law, but this whole cultural change with regard to marriage has a much greater impact on our culture outside of the court system. And I'd like to just talk about several of them. One is, what is the impact of this judicial tyranny that Rita has just described on our own families and our own children? Secondly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the rule of law in more general terms, what the impact of this has been on the rule of law in our states. Thirdly, and John, I'd welcome your comments on this, I'd like to talk about the impact on the church, and finally, on liberty, on freedom. So I'm going to start off with what impact this judicial intrusion has been on marriage and the families. For this reason, by legalizing and recognizing something besides natural marriage, and like you, I don't know what to call it because it's not marriage, but we'll just call it strange marriage, false marriage, counterfeit marriage. By their breaking down the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman, they have opened the gates to what we call a slippery slope. People laughed at us in 2006 when we said, if you're going to open the door to this same-sex relationship, then you're going to open the door to polygamy, polyamory, which means multiple relationships. They scoffed at us. It's happening now. The polygamists are on a roll. And you know, you sent me something recently where there's a daughter who wants to marry her father now. Why not?
I was in USA Today.
Because we have broken down, we have destroyed the biblical standard and our historic experience with marriages between one man and one woman. Therefore, anything goes. And as we saw last spring in the march before the federal court in Richmond, marry who you love. Oh, really? I went up to the lady holding that, said, I'd like to marry my daughter. Would that be all right with you? She had no answer. She turned away. There is no answer. If you can marry who you love, you can marry your daughter, you can marry your cousin, you can marry three women, marry who you love. I love her. Can I marry her?
And I just want to point out, because this is something that has always bothered me about the argument in favor of same-sex marriage. Under the traditional definition of marriage, no one is given the right to just marry whomever they love. There is a definition, a standard, and everyone is entitled to enter into marriage as long as they meet that definition. No one is given a right to marry anybody they love. That is just not the way it works.
Well, then you've responded to the question that we're all often getting. Well, you're either homophobic or you're discriminatory. And it's not about either one. It is not about a dislike of people who've chosen that lifestyle. It is not taking rights away from them, as Rita has just described. And that really brings me to the next one, the rule of law. What this has done to the rule of law. Rita has just described that the courts have really usurped the authority of our legislative bodies. It's like they have no power anymore. The courts will decide. Well, why do we need a legislature anymore? They have not only usurped the authority of our General Assembly, they have usurped our vote. In 2006, we won that vote by 57%. Now they're saying the legislature doesn't matter, the people's vote doesn't matter. We will decide, as you said last week, the judges will decide what law is. It's whatever we make.
Well, Dean, this may lead you into the next one about the church. Someone said to me, John, you're right. You know, that law passed by 57% in Virginia, but studies show that it probably would not pass in Virginia today. So something is happening in Virginia, and is it because the church has been silent and because people have simply not gotten involved?
Well, I'll get to that, but I'd like to address that first comment first. That is the law. And so to speculate that because people may have changed their minds, we're going to ignore the law
Agreed.
Is a reckless argument.
Agreed.
Now, the second thing is with regard to the church. You're in a better position to say this, to talk about this than I. But yes, I think all of us agree that the church has for too long been too silent on the importance of marriage, the definition of marriage. But that really comes back to another point. We have to clean up our own
house. It's not, Dean, so much that the church has been silent. There has been silence. But regrettably, the church has been proactive in redefining marriage because of the liberals in our seminaries and in our pulpits who no longer believe that the Bible is the authoritative word of God. So the church, regrettably, is leading on this. My own denomination has recently redefined marriage to open it up to be between two males or two females, and it's because they're driven. They're being pushed by the culture, but they are changing the idea that the Bible is God's revelation of truth. It's simply man's idea at a particular point in history.
The other thing that has happened is that the segment of our society who has advocated for same-sex marriage has somehow been successful at framing this issue as an issue of equality versus discrimination, which, as I pointed out a moment ago, is absolutely wrong. Defining marriage as an exclusive union of one man and one woman has nothing to do with discrimination. It's defined that way for purposes of public policy, even apart from what the Bible says about it. For purposes of public policy, the whole reason the state is involved with marriage at all is because the state has an interest in making sure that our children are raised in the environment that is particularly suited for the rearing and nurturing of children.
And this, John, I want to get back to the church and then address what Rita just said. I remember you're saying, maybe you're going to deny this, But something to the effect that we ought to close down all our seminaries and start over again.
Oh, yeah,
because so many
I have said if I were the Pope and the Presbyterians had a Pope and I had unlimited authority, I would close down the seminaries and start over again. And
yes.
It required that every seminary professor had to be in the parish for at least 15 years before going to the ivory tower because they lose connection with the grassroots.
Well, and also you talked about your denomination going down this slippery slope and accepting same-sex relationships, and I think we must remind our listeners that we have a Christian, self-identified Christian university in the Valley that seems to have lost sight of biblical authority, and I'm talking about Eastern Mennonite University, who apparently, reportedly, by their own statement, are considering whether or not to hire faculty members and staff members who are engaged in the same-sex relationship. So it is a cancer that is spreading in our culture. But I'd like now to get back to what Rita said. This is definitely affecting the fourth major area, and that is freedom. Mm-hmm. Because it is no longer about tolerance. The activists who are trying to press their case about same-sex marriage are at the same time saying you cannot say anything against same-sex marriage or we're going to come after you, we're going to penalize you. And I have in front of me a number of cases, and I won't go into detail, but there are bakers in Oregon who have been penalized, $150,000 fine because they wouldn't make cakes for a wedding ceremony. So you have bakers, wedding photographers, innkeepers, owners of wedding reception halls, even churches. The case in Houston where the mayor has gone after pastors because they might have said something in their sermons. Or in Atlanta where the mayor has fired the fire chief because he said something personally that gave the biblical view of marriage. This is coming after us. I also have an 8-page document from Massachusetts. In the 12 years or 11 years now since they passed the same-sex marriage, the impact on schools, on churches, on businesses has been enormous. So there is a ripple effect, and it is affecting our freedom.
Well, where do we go from here? How can our listeners be involved? What can we do to help inform ourselves about this Supreme Court upcoming decision? Clearly, we can pray. What are some other specifics? Where do we go?
I think the first thing, John, is really to come before God in repentance for the way that we have gotten off his path. He has a very clear purpose and design for our lives, for our families. Among the three of us here, we have 100 years of experience in marriage. You and I have 88, and then this stripling comes along, and she has a couple years. But, John, you and I know, and Rita knows, marriage is a beautiful institution of God. And you have become one tree with Gwen. Your two trees have so integrated, you can't tell one tree from the other.
I can actually finish her thoughts, which she doesn't appreciate.
But what I'm saying is this is a beautiful design. We have to get back to that design in our own lives, in our cultures, in our churches, and we have to speak out. This is truth, and we can no longer stay silent in the face of intimidation.
Rita, you have a final word?
Well, you're definitely going to be, we're all going to be hearing about this decision coming up. So I don't think folks will have to look very hard to find information about it. But I would just really encourage everyone to challenge the idea that the traditional definition of marriage is somehow about discrimination. That it is just not accurate to say that. And if you really think about it, I think it becomes clear. So we just need to challenge that way of thinking.
Well, this is such an important issue, and we'll come back to this. I believe in a couple of weeks we'll come back to talk about marriage as well and how to restore marriage. But for now, thank you, Rita and Dean, for another informative and challenging program. And thank you, our listeners, for joining us each week. We want you to know that all of our Crossroads programs are on file and are online at www.valleyfamilyforum.org. So you can go back and listen to any of the programs, tell your friends about it. One of my former associates lives in California, and she is going to be listening to our programs in California.
I got word from a friend in Florida. He said, Dean, I want to listen to it online. Tell me where. So we are going viral.
And we want you to contact us with your input. questions, concerns. If you want to disagree with us, take us to task. Write us at crossroadsharrisonburg@gmail.com. Well, friends, tune in next week for a conversation about the greatly misunderstood issue of the so-called separation of church and state. Till then, this is John Sloop along with Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty, challenging you to be salt and light and to make a difference for Christ at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.